This is Lawrence Tuning, and these are my 88 friends.
Me and my 88 friends. Me and my 88 friends. I will sing you a song that will help me along. They're my one man band. I'm the number one fan. But that was a mistake. She said she liked the music. It had a catchy tune. She knew a singer whose style it fit. She said she'd see what she could do. But there was just one problem. She said those words are much too bold. Just a bit, or we'll never get it sold. Jesus, I don't want to keep you here. Jesus, after all you went and did, I don't want to keep it quiet. I don't want to go low-key. I want to shout.
Welcome to episode 142 of Me and My 88 Friends. This is Lawrence Tuning, your host. I'm sitting beside the person I have now dubbed the Surgeon General, Brian Hoogenboom. His editing skills are legendary, at least in my mind. It is unbelievable what this guy can do with a pair of scalpels. Do they call them scalpels? Cutting tool. That's what they call it on the computer. Anyway, we've got a wonderful interview tonight by my friend Kim Hornbeck. Now, if the name Hornbeck sounds familiar, it's because we interviewed Kim's husband, Randy, last week. They live in Moravian Falls, North Carolina. Both of them have wonderful testimonies. When I think about Kim and the interview we had, I'm reminded of that wonderful song that we all sing in church. The third verse says, "Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Twas grace hath led me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home." Kim's testimony is a testimony of God's grace in the midst of all the many seasons of life. It's a wonderful conversation. So let's go straight to that conversation that we had on the phone on August 9th, 2020. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Lawrence.
I want to read a verse here before we start talking. This is Revelation 12, verse 10 and 11. It says, "Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, 'Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. For the accuser of our brothers who accuses them before our God day and night has been hurled down.'" And then the next verse, which is what I really want to read, "They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death." And one of the things when I was asked to do this podcast, I thought, wouldn't it be great to record a lot of people's testimonies? Mm-hmm. And so, because according to the Word, that's one of the ways the enemy is defeated. So, Randy was so great, and I know you've got a great story too. So we're going to talk about your life today.
Okay.
So, do I have this right that you grew up in Ohio?
That is right. Yep.
Okay. What town?
In Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio.
I'm a Buckeye.
Are you a Buckeye fan?
Probably not as much as my mother and my sister. They got kind of wild.
Buckeye fans are just
right.
They're crazy. You know, I've never seen fans like that.
Well, I'll tell you, my claim to fame, though, is my high school was one of the best football teams. And I don't know if you're old enough or anybody's old enough to remember a player called Archie Griffin.
Yes.
He got the Heisman Trophy one year when playing for the Ohio State Buckeyes. But anyway, I went to high school with him, graduated with him. So that's
wow.
My claim.
Did you grow up in a church going home?
No, not really. I remember some years that my parents took me to Sunday school as a child, but it was, you know, probably kindergarten through first, second grade, something like that. So I had memories of that, but then suddenly we just stopped going, and I really didn't understand why. And I didn't know until years later that my father had been on the board of deacons. It was a Methodist church.
Uh-huh.
And he was on the board of deacons, and somehow, you know, somebody said something that offended him, and that was it. He just closed the door, walked away, and didn't go back to church again for the rest of his life. So any church?
He didn't go to any church? Okay.
Right. My dad, he was a salesman, tried a couple of different things. Salesman, went into real estate, and sometimes he would be away on business. And I actually learned later in life that a lot of times when I thought he was away on a business trip, he actually had been admitted into the hospital. He suffered from mental illness. And at the time, it was, you know, state hospital, mental hospital. And that was just one of the many family secrets that I grew up with and didn't really understand a lot of things until later. But, you know, my dad was a very performance-driven man, and he had a real estate business. He also had he had purchased a ranch. And that was kind of a couple of fun years. He hosted what was known as the Big National Country Show at Frontier Ranch. And it was during the era of, like, you know, beginning of Johnny Cash and George Jones and Bill Anderson. And so here I am, you know, a 10-year-old kid, you know, and all these famous people are around. And it was a lot of fun.
So they came to your house?
Well, not the house. We owned a ranch. It was an acre. We had things like horseback riding and shelter houses where families could come and have reunions, hay rides in the fall, sleigh rides in the winter. And the summer was these big national country shows.
So did you meet some of the stars?
I did.
You know, I'm kind of starstruck, but I met Ernest Tubb one time and got his autograph. I met Pat Boone one time. But okay, who did you meet? Who was the most impressive person that you met?
Oh, my goodness. I would say probably Johnny Cash. I'm saying that because I have a memory of him as a kid, but, you know, of all the different country music people, he's probably one that I continued to enjoy the music. But at the time, he wasn't real. He definitely was not in his Christian state at the time. So anyway, you know, we owned the ranch and he had real estate business. And like I said, he was very performance driven. And, you know, as I've become an adult, you know, I understand so much more about that and his family background. But suddenly when I was in the sixth grade, and again, I didn't understand it, but his businesses, both of them, just kind of failed. And he and my mom had to declare bankruptcy. And that led to, we had a couple of different moves. And it seemed like every time we moved into a smaller home. And it was just a real financial struggle for them. Of course, again, I didn't really understand it. But what began to happen with my dad is I just saw that there was this anger that just was displayed in the home. It was getting worse. And, you know, sometimes violent behavior and abuses, you know, toward my mom, and having to call the police a couple of times. And so here I am, you know, that started happening probably, you know, 12, 13.
So did you see the abuse? Did you see your dad get violent with your mom?
Yeah, I did. I just remember one time. Actually, my older sisters probably have, you know, another perspective as well. But all that just kind of culminated. And then when I was 15, my dad actually committed suicide. So that is a shock to a family's system, and especially at the age of 15. But what happened in my case was my two older sisters, I'm the youngest of four. I'm the baby of the family. So I had two older sisters, and I had a brother who was 3 years older than me, but he had Down syndrome. Uh-huh. So it was just my brother and I that were in the home when my dad took his life. So I just had to become the caretaker of the family. And, you know, I know that you've done social work, and you've probably, you know, maybe people know about the different studies that are, you know, everybody has a role that they play in families. And the caretaker, or sometimes they say the rescuer, is described as the person that really absorbs and attempts to resolve the family's issues. And so, that's sort of how what I became. That's who I became.
So did you feel like you had to look after your mother and be the one to help her get on her feet emotionally and that sort of thing?
Yes, okay. I did.
And did y'all have any clue that your dad was
would do that.
Yeah, or it was kind of teetering on the brink.
No, I don't think so. My mother may have, but you know, I just remember the morning that he left. You know, he and I had an angry exchange. Actually, I said that because of the bankruptcy, we moved from home to home, and the homes kept getting smaller and smaller. And actually, the home we lived in at the time, there was no bedroom for me. So I slept in the living room. So after he was gone, I moved into my mom's bedroom. And so, yeah, pretty much I was just kind of taking care of her, taking care of my brother with Down syndrome. And so he was 18 at the time. And Lawrence, you gotta remember at that time when my brother was born in 1951, pretty much parents were told just put your child in an institution,
right.
You know, and
yep.
They said, no, just put him away. And so, you know, when he was 18 and my father died, he was still in the home, and they were just beginning to have certain programs where handicapped or Down syndrome could go to a craft center or whatever, you know, to a warehouse, whatever, and do that. And so, but we really, he didn't do that regularly. It became, from the time I was 15 until I graduated from high school, really, my brother became more and more difficult for my mom and I to manage, to take care of. He would become abusive with us. And it was toward the end of my senior year that my high school counselor sat down with my mom and said, you know, you really need to do something. So by the time, right after I got out of high school, I graduated from high school, she had made the decision to put him in a home. She was left penniless, so she had to work. So anyway, that's kind of what happened in those immediate years.
So during that time, did you know any Christian friends, or did you have any sort of contact with Christianity, or even like feeling the presence of the Lord or anything like that?
Well, actually, you know, I was at the time invited by some school friends to their youth group, Methodist Church. And it was a different Methodist church than I had remembered as a kid. But yeah, I spent my high school years, you know, getting involved with that youth group. And I would tell you that I believed in God, but I really wasn't taught about and didn't feel that I had a relationship with Jesus. And pretty much I'm this kid, I'm this responsible kid who just, you know, you follow the regulations. So yeah, 10 commandments. Yeah. Okay. That's what you do. That's what a Christian's all about. So yeah, I did have some influence at that time, but what happened after I graduated from high school, I made the decision to go to a business school in New York City. And I tell people, I cannot believe my mother let me do this, move to New York City on my own at age 18. But I did. And that was really the time that I just, you know, I got out of the home, and I just kind of went off the rails. I just started drinking a lot, and, you know, the expression of looking for love in all the wrong places, that was exactly how I was living my life. And so I was at the business school in New York City, but on the weekends, I would go up to upstate New York in the Catskill Mountain region. Mm-hmm. And I had started, when I was 16, I had started working in the resorts up there. And so I did that the summer when I was 16, 17, 18, you know. So here I am in New York City at a school. And so on the weekends, I would just go up to upstate and to the area and where I had worked and just do my bar scene.
Isn't that where Dirty Dancing took place in the movie?
Oh, yeah.
Was it the Catskills or the Adirondacks?
Yeah. It says it was the Catskills, right?
Yeah.
And Yeah, you talk to some people.
They filmed that in North Carolina, but I think the movie.
They did. Yes, they did. Yeah, a couple different. And Virginia. There's a hotel in Virginia where they filmed some of it. Anyway, one of those weekends up there, I left with the guy that I was with, both of us drunk, and we were in an accident. And he missed a curve in the road, and it was by a bridge, and it wasn't like a big tall bridge. This was up in the country, you know, up in the mountains. And so it was just a small bridge, but the truck went over the bridge into the embankment, and by all accounts, I should have been under the water. You know, I should have been. I was on the passenger side. I hit the dashboard. I still have a scar on my chin from it. But everybody came by and said, how in the world did you survive that? I remember thinking at the time, you know, and saying to God, why did you let me live? You know, everybody's, you know, and I remember that was kind of I'd say a little seed of the Holy Spirit starting to draw me, you know, because right. I just really had a sense God saved me for some reason. I don't know why, but I'm here.
Now, were you 18 at that time, or were you older?
Yeah, I was 18, maybe 19.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah. But, you know, after I spent a year in that business school, and then I moved back home because my brother was actually, he was in the state hospital by then. He actually got sick. And so I went home, and he actually did pass away when he was in that hospital. So I was there, you know, stayed that year with my mom again. But by the following summer, by the summer of 1974, I decided I wanted to move back to New York. I started at the summer of 1974, went to a different resort to work as a waitress. I'm still just living my carousing lifestyle. There was a waitress, though, that was... that I was working with, and she started witnessing to me, you know, and kept inviting me to her church. And I thought, yeah, you know, maybe later I'll try it. So I, you know, she kind of persisted, and actually I decided after that summer job was over, I decided I was going to stay, and told my mom I'm going to stay. I really love it up here. And so this waitress says, well, you know, I'm getting ready to get an apartment. Would you want to share an apartment with me? So decided to do that. So one day I just decided, she kept inviting me to church. One day I just decided I'll go ahead and I'll go visit. And I walked into, it was a Lutheran church. I didn't know much about Lutherans, but I walked into the church, and here sits this guy that I knew from a band. He was the drummer in a band that had played at one of the resorts that I worked at. And I looked at him and I thought, what the heck is he doing here? He was he was such a jerk. I thought, I cannot believe that he's sitting here in this church. Of course, he recognized me, and after the service came over to talk to me. And he's telling me all about Jesus, you know, and how he's come to the Lord. And he was from an Italian family, Catholic Italian family. And so I'm like, well, this is really interesting, you know. And of course, he gave me a really good, you know, the gospel message, and shared with me about that Jesus loved me and would forgive me and could turn my life around, you know, just like God had forgiven him. And you know, I remember thinking, you know, and he prayed for me, but
He prayed for you.
Yeah, he prayed for me, but I wasn't ready. I just, what stopped me, Lawrence, was I thought, how in the world can God forgive me for the way I've been living my life? And it was just so hard for me to, because I had such shame. And it was just so hard for me to believe it. I just, and then the other thing was that the reason I didn't pray at that time was I was afraid. I was afraid, what if I said, you know, repented and asked Jesus into my heart? What if I didn't have the strength to change?
Right. Let me ask you something before you go any further.
Yeah.
Were you turned off by the guy at first when he started?
No. Sort of... My curiosity.
Okay.
Got to me.
And how about this waitress? How about your roommate? Did she turn you off when she would tell you about the Lord, or was there something about her life that was real?
Oh yeah, she was one of these joyful, bubbly people. Yeah. So.
Okay, yeah. So you were afraid that you would fail at it, and you were you didn't think you deserved it, or you know, how could God forgive somebody like me?
Right. Yeah. So the guy had said, and my roommate, the girl, she said, well, why don't you come on to the pastor some on Wednesday night? He does a Bible study, and it's just really, it's a lot of fun, and they, you know, they have snacks and blah, blah, blah. So I thought, okay, I'll try the Wednesday night Bible study. When I walked into that home, the pastor's wife, one of these other, I mean, she just embraced me and hugged me and just, oh, I'm so glad you're here. Barbara's told us all about you. And, you know, just, it was so welcoming. And I know when Randy told you his story, he had
an older lady hug him, the same thing.
Right, exactly. So I just went away from there just feeling so loved. And I went back to my apartment. And alone in my bedroom that night, I surrendered. And I just said, okay, Lord Jesus, I believe you. And repented and asked him to come into my heart and just deliver me from, you know, the lifestyle and the shame. And I tell you, I just had immediate peace.
So were you all alone when you prayed?
I was all alone in my bedroom. I didn't even call my roommate. You know, I just did it all on my own in my bedroom.
So you kind of knew what to do. You knew.
Yeah.
So, wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I was never again drawn back into that lifestyle, that immoral lifestyle. But well, I'll tell you what I was drawn to after that immediately. You know, I just couldn't wait to go back to that Wednesday night Bible study. And I was just, the way the pastor talked out of the Bible, I mean, I was just drawn to the word immediately. And, you know, Lawrence, the Jeremiah, there's a verse in chapter 15, he talks about how he ate God's words because of his joy and his heart's delight. And that's what I experienced. And so, you know, I just got really involved in the church, and I actually wound up moving into the pastor and his wife. She was pregnant with their third child. It was kind of an unexpected pregnancy. And, you know, she was really kind of tired a lot and just needed help with the two girls that she already had. And so they asked me, I won't go into the story about why I felt I needed to not live with the roommate anymore. But they said, well, why don't you just come live here? You can help Joan, and we can help you in your walk with the Lord. And it was just a marvelous time. It was just a really soaking time for me just to learn the word, and not only the Wednesday night Bible study, but I started going to a ladies' prayer meeting. And the interesting thing, this is so cool. The interesting thing is that the ladies' prayer meeting, it was not just the Lutheran women, but there were four Catholic women there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I know in recent months, you know, the Jesus Revolution movie and my own husband came out of that, was affected by that, coming out of the hippie drug culture, that type of thing. But for me, what I was a part of back there, back in upstate New York at the time, there was a Catholic church that many of the women had gotten baptized in the Holy Spirit.
Right.
During the time of the Catholic charismatic renewal, I don't know if you heard, you know, there were some...
We had a couple of people on the show about a month ago, and they came to the Lord through charismatic Catholic prayer meeting.
Yeah. And then what I began to realize is one of those Catholic women was the mom of the guy who had witnessed to me.
The drummer's mother.
And he, yeah. So he, you know, so that's where, you know, and so it was so cool. When the first time I went there to the prayer meeting, they just embraced me and they said, "We are so glad you're here. We have prayed for you for months."
Oh my goodness. Okay, I want to back up just a second here. I read somewhere, I think George Barna, the polling guy that does all these polls for church life and all, he said, or somebody said, that most people choose a church based on their first impression, like the first 30 seconds. And I'm thinking about when you came to that original meeting and the lady came and hugged you. I take it from what you said, that's one of the reasons you felt comfortable there, right?
Yes, exactly.
And how would that have been? I wonder if people have been stiff and just sort of hello, but no warmth or whatever. It's wild. What town in New York was it? You say upstate New York.
It was the Catskill Mountain Range.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Actually, it was the town of, you know, there's Cairo, Egypt.
Yep.
The town was called, spelled the same way, but we pronounced it Cairo.
Yeah.
And it's real similar. Yeah. And so the one thing I wanted to, you know, to say about those Catholic women and that ladies' prayer meeting is, you know, when they told me they had been praying for me for months, my friend, you know, that I worked with, she had given them, you know, my name and asked that they be praying for me. But one of the things I didn't tell you was toward the end of that fall, just before I went to visit at the church, I began to lose my taste for alcohol. And I would just, you know, and I tell you, I attribute everything that was a part of me being drawn and coming to the Lord, including losing my taste for alcohol, including coming to the church, the Bible study, all of that, to that lady's prayer meeting.
Oh, that's great. That's wonderful.
Yeah, I like to tell people, you know what? Praying for wayward ones works. It really does.
You know, there's people need to hear that right there. That is so true. You're listening to episode 142 of Me and My 88 Friends. This is Lawrence Tuning, your host. And we're talking to my friend Kim Hornback, who was sharing about her journey of faith. Up to this point, we've heard her journey to the cross, her journey up to the point where Jesus became real in her life. After coming to Christ, Kim felt led to move to Minnesota when a door opened up for her to work as a secretary for a ministry there. It was in Minnesota that she met her husband, Randy, who was also working for that church. They later resettled in Anderson, Indiana, and we want to pick the story up with their marriage and their life after. So what year did you get married to Randy?
1977, you know, and it just really amazes me to this day that God had me marry a hippie, because I had no grid for, I mean, I knew what hippies were, but here I was, this good little girl that, follow the rules, follow the regulation. And here's within a couple months, I was pregnant. And so we just decided we want to move back to Indiana, because if we're starting our family, we want to be near grandparents, you know, our kids to be near grandparents. So, of course, Randy was from Anderson, born and raised in Anderson, and I was Columbus, Ohio. So it's just about 3 hours apart. We thought settling in Anderson, you know, would be good.
Had three daughters.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
So said I was pregnant when we got there. And so our oldest daughter, Amy, was born in August of 78. Her infancy was difficult. She cried a lot. In fact, I desired to have women's Bible studies, and I can remember she would just be so fussy in the evenings. And when I had women's Bible study, the only thing Randy could do would be put her in the car and drive around for an hour and a half because she would settle down. She would go to sleep in the car seat. It wasn't until she was 9 months old, or actually when she was 8 months old, something happened that we had to get her to the hospital right away. It was discovered, we were told that she, at 9 months old, that she had cystic fibrosis. You get a diagnosis like that, and I was like, I don't know that we know what that is, you know? And so we had to learn what it was and how to take care of her. Basically, for anyone that doesn't know, cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease. It affects the lungs and the pancreas. And, you know, if you can imagine, the easiest way to describe it is if when you have a bad cold and you have a lot of mucus all clogged up in your nose, or, you know, and you're coughing it up and, you know, trying to get it out, that's how the mucus is in the lungs of a cystic and what it's like in the pancreas, the ducts. And so it blocks. So there are digestive problems and there prone to lung infections. So that's basically, and here it was a genetic disease. And we were just like, well, what does that mean? And it means that, you know, the man, the woman, people either carry the CF gene or they don't. And at the time, I mean, now there's testing. You know, if there's a couple that's going to get married and they want to be tested, I imagine there's all kinds of stuff you can find out ahead of time now. But back then, you only found out when, you know, two carriers marry. And even then, every time there's a pregnancy, it's a 25% chance that the child will have cystic fibrosis. So we spent the next few years learning how to take care of her. And of course, we prayed. We had wanted more children. In fact, Randy told me he wouldn't mind having 10 kids. And I'm like still amazed. I went ahead and married him anyway.
It's amazing how many guys think that would be such a great thing. And yeah. I've said before that, you know, the guys get the happy. It's all happiness. They don't have to go through what the woman has to go through. But so, yeah, I've had other people say that. Did you ever say, God, I know your word says you heal the sick? And I mean, did you ever go through a dark time questioning God where he seemed so far away and that sort of thing?
Oh, my, yes. Yes. Healing is, and especially when it's a genetic, we actually had someone tell us that we needed to cast the demon out of her.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of opinions out there and all kinds of things that we had to weather.
Right.
And they asked, why was the blind man born blind? Was it that he had sinned? Or was it that his parents? And the answer from the Lord is neither one.
Right. Yeah.
This happened for God's glory. And so we clung to that because there's no way any of us will be experts in this field, you know, and how we can answer all the questions that come up.
Can I ask you a question? Did you worry that, okay, if we have more children, they might have it too?
Exactly. We did. And we prayed and we wanted more kids, and we finally just decided, you know, we're just going to have more. You know, we want more, and we're just going to trust God. So, you know, I got pregnant with our second daughter, Megan. And the interesting thing, Lawrence, is at the time, I mean, now, again, they can test a pregnant woman. But at the time, they couldn't do the genetic test to find out if the child had cystic fibrosis until after she was born and at least 6 weeks old. Well, while I was still, I don't know, in my eighth or ninth month of pregnancy with her, we had this Scottish minister and his wife come to share in the church, in the fellowship. And they, you know, we opened our home. They spent the time with us, stayed in our home. And, you know, he said, well, I want to pray. Of course, people come into our home and they see all the, you know, the different medications and the treatments. I used to have to pound on Amy, do the what respiratory therapists do to break up the mucus. And so I learned how to do that. So anyone staying in the home would see that. So, you know, we had discussions with them. And before they left our home, they said, we want to pray. And they spent time praying. And they broke any generational curses. You know, you're talking about something genetic. Mm-hmm. And they also, and they just prophetically encouraged us and said, you know what? This is not going to visit your family again. And so we were encouraged by that. And sure enough, Megan's born. 6 weeks later, she gets the test and it's negative. She does not have cystic fibrosis. Megan, after the difficult time of infancy and childhood, you know, with Amy, Megan was just, she was kind of like my baby of grace.
Yeah, yeah.
She slept well, she ate well, and just was a little bit quieter in her demeanor, than what Amy was. And so we decided, you know, 3 years later, get pregnant again. And our daughter Leah was born in 1985. The pediatrician right ahead, when he the very first thing when he examined her, he said, I think I hear a heart murmur. And we just went, oh, you know, and he said, you know what? A lot of babies are born with just a little hole in their heart and it just closes up over time. He just wasn't very concerned about it. I remember Randy specifically rocking her to sleep one night and just crying and praying, Lord, please let her be okay. Yeah. And we had to fight, you know, like we began, because what happened was she nursed well and slept okay. But I mean, whenever I would nurse her, you pick the baby up and you go to pat the baby on the back. And she would just lose it. She would lose all of her milk. It was more than just spit up. She mm-hmm. It would just gush out. Actually, when she was 4 months old, at her 3 month checkup, the pediatrician said, yeah, you know, we might think about sending you to a pediatric cardiologist at Riley Children's Hospital, which we were fine with. That was where Amy's care was all the time. I cannot remember if we had the appointment with the cardiologist when this happened or if we got sent afterward. But anyway, at 4 months old, Leah developed congestive heart failure. And so we had to, she was immediately seen and put on medication and scheduled for a heart catheterization for them to assess, would she need surgery? What were we dealing with? And so she was scheduled for the heart catheterization on a certain day, and Amy had an appointment that day. So I think we probably scheduled the two together just so we would only have one trip to make. And so we get there. Amy was 7 at the time. We get there, and Amy's checkup reveals that she's got a bad lung infection, and they want to admit her. And I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
So here we are. Amy's being admitted to the hospital and I've got Leah. And at the time, you know, they probably wouldn't allow it now, but they allowed me to sleep in a chair and they brought in a pack and play so that I could have Leah with me. And so, you know, and actually that was Amy's first hospitalization, her first lung infection. Anyway, short story on that is, well, and here's our daughter, Megan, the middle child, which middle child has some heartaches sometimes, but here she was thinking, well, I wish something was wrong with me so I could go in the hospital. So, but anyway, the short end of the story of that story is that we did have to schedule Leah for open heart surgery. They wanted to wait for a few months and let her gain weight, which it was kind of a catch 22. Well, she's not going to gain weight because she's got this hole in her heart, but you won't go in and do the surgery until she weighs more. So right, I think they did schedule it when she was 11 months old. She had open heart surgery. We joke about when the doctors, before they sewed up the hole, they put a jumping bean in her heart because she became so active. And to this day, I mean, she runs marathons. She now has five boys. And then she's just a constant go, 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 you know, just loves to, you know, be involved and help at her boys' school and doing all kinds of things. She's very gifted creatively. And so it's just fun to see how God has taken her, the hole in the heart. And yeah. So anyway, that was kind of our journey in the 1980s. We were just barely hanging on sometimes. And I remember during those times just thinking, I just am so tired. I just can't pray. And, mm-hmm. you know, I just don't know that I have the faith to make it through. And remember, I'm that caretaker. I'm that rescuer. And I'm trying to fix everything.
Right. Yeah.
I'm trying to fix everything. Just all this stuff happening. And the Lord took me to Psalm 18. And I just want to read this to you. Some of these verses. He reached down from on high and he took hold of me. He drew me out of deep waters. He rescued me from my powerful enemy, from my foes who were too strong for me. They confronted me in the day of my disaster, but the Lord was my support. He brought me out into a spacious place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. And when I read that he rescued me because he delighted in me, I was like, you delight in me? That's why you're here? You're going to take care of us because you delight in me? That was a huge thing for me, Lawrence, because what I had gone through from my father, I just felt people don't delight in. I just had this feeling about myself. And so I just, you know, it was a huge healing time for me, for the Lord to give me those verses. And I continue to have times in my life where I always go to the Word, and I know as long as He will show me what the truth is, what He's doing, who He is, who I am, then I can cling and I can make it through. And cling, He'll cling to me.
That's right. There's another verse that I ran into that says, He delights in the prayers of His people.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, you actually delight when we sit down and talk to you.
Exactly.
And there's that other verse that says, we used to sing that song years ago in the fellowship. The Lord your God is in your midst, a warrior who saves.
Yep.
He will exult over you with shouts of joy. And I read that word exult actually means jump for joy.
Mm-hmm.
And over us, Amy lived a lot longer than they thought she would live, right?
Yes, she did. When they first gave us the diagnosis and the genetic people sat down with us, they said, life expectancy right now, you can expect that she will live into her teen years. Obviously, she really defied that, you know, and there were a lot of reasons for that, we believe. Of course, we believe God works through scientists and doctors and medicine and technologies and advances and all of that.
Right.
We believe, of course, that the Lord had a lot to do with all of that. Whether it was from the medical thing or whether it was a sovereign touch on her life. she also had this incredible gift of laughter. And I can remember going to visits. They would say, well, does she have a productive cough? And I said, yeah, we just make her laugh and then show her if she coughs. So, yeah.
Even that's a scriptural. Laughter, the Bible talks about laughter being medicine or whatever. So, yeah. So tell the people listening how old she lived to be.
Okay. So she, through the years, you know, after she graduated from high school, she really had wanted to do mission work. And so she spent some time with Youth with a Mission, YWAM, which took her to Russia and to China. And she went to college, got a degree in language and linguistics, and, you know, was able to stay in China for 4 months and teach English. But then she also, at one point in her life, felt that it would be good for her to live in a dry climate. And so she moved to, she was in Arizona for about 5 years. And all throughout when she was in Arizona that she wound up ill enough that she needed to come and live with us. And so she did that. And she lived with us in, you know, from 2009 to 2014. And actually we had Megan and her son with us. We've had to skip ahead in the interim in the 2000s, all these new paths, you know, right. You know, we've started having grandkids and everything, but Amy would want to be out on her own. And she did go out on her own. You know, she lived with us for a while and her health would be good. And then she, you know, moved back to Indiana for a while. And then probably in 2016, I think it was, she needed to move back in with us. By 2019, she was so bad that we were meeting with doctors about her having a double lung transplant. She was on oxygen 24/7 pretty much. And when we went for those talks and they tested her and they said, well, you really, I mean, her lung functions are down to like in the 20s, 20%. Mm. And saying, you know, there's this new medicine we want you to try first. We don't think you need or you're ready. The good news is you're not sick enough for the lung transplant. So there was this new drug, and so she started on it. And that new medicine, just a pill twice a day in 2020, just brought new life to her. It was immediate. Here she is. She's got brand new life and she's got the freedom to travel. And here hits COVID. Things are shut down. And it was a terribly frustrating time for her. But, you know, we weathered through that. And so in 2020 to 2022, so she was 43 in 2021. So 2022, in the January, February timeframe, she had gotten off of oxygen except for the at nighttime. But she began to see toward the end, you know, in February that she was needing to bump up her oxygen liters, and sometimes she would even put it on in the day. There was a Friday, I believe it was, in February where she suddenly just panicked because she couldn't breathe and called Randy. Randy was retired by this time. I think, you know, he talked briefly about our jobs that we had first. It was a rush to get her to the emergency room. And they discovered blood clots in her lungs. And so the decision was made pretty quickly to get her sent down to her main hospital, which is the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, about 3 hours away. And so she spent a week in the hospital there. They got started resolving the blood clots, but they discovered a mass in her abdomen. And so various testings, trying to do a biopsy, not being able to do it. After a week, basically, she came home and they said, we're probably going to have to do surgery to figure out what that mass is, take it out, you know, and we're thinking they just couldn't tell. Was it by vital organs? What was it? You know, it was just a mystery. So we brought her home, and within a day and a half, she passed.
That was last year, right? Was it last year?
Yeah. March 1st, 2022. So she lived. She would have been 44 in 2022. So she lived till she was 43. And
she wasn't supposed to live till teenage years.
Here's the thing, too. She didn't die from cystic fibrosis. You know, it's still a mystery, and so that we're still grappling with some of those things. But, you know, she had her license plate was I win. And
she did win.
She was so victorious in her life, so resilient, and loved the Lord. And especially in those last, from 2020 until her death, she loved the Lord. She glorified him. We are so grateful, you know, that she had peace, and we saw that, the peace that God had given to her, that no matter what she was facing, she was okay. She had surrendered her life to him. You know, Lawrence, death is an experience. I mean, we're all going to experience it, just ourselves, but I mean, family members, loved ones. And sometimes, you know, we've got the knowledge ahead of time that it's coming. You know, I had that with my mom. I had the opportunity to be, again, a caretaker for her in her last days. And so, you know, sometimes we have the opportunity to prepare our hearts and others for it. But and in one sense, all of our lives, we knew that it was possible that Amy might pass before us. But the last 2 years of her life, she was just so alive.
Yeah.
And not having to do her treatments and lots of medicines, that was gone. That was not a part of her daily routine anymore. Her sisters told us they thought about bringing the boys to see her when she was in the hospital. And they just thought, she's been in the hospital lots of times. She'll bounce back. It's just a shock and a mystery when death comes that way. I know that from the way that my father died, and Randy's mom death was a sudden thing. But you know, I've told you how important the Word of God has been in my life. And when Amy was in the hospital, I asked the Lord, do you have something in your word you can, you know, tell me what's going on, or, you know, something I can hold on to? And he just spoke to Job 121, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And I said to the Lord, I don't want that verse.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
I was real. I said, I don't want that verse, but I know now that he was preparing me.
Yeah.
The time coming that he was going to take her. You know, her pilgrimage on earth was over, and the last few days were difficult ones for her. And as she cried out, you know, we just prayed, Lord, answer her cries. We believe that he did that. And, you know, I've spent the months since losing her just journaling my confusion, my questions, my heartache. And God has just met me. He continues to meet me.
Isn't it great that the God we serve doesn't mind when we just tell him our frustrations and our confusion? Do you know, I've heard people say, well, don't ever confess anything negative. But I mean, and I understand that you don't complain and all that, but I'm just so glad that we can cry out to him and just pour our heart out to him. And he's always willing to listen. I know that Amy made an impact on a lot of people, because when she died, I mean, it was incredible. I didn't get to go to the funeral, but just on Facebook, all the different people that mm-hmm. were responding. And, wow, this has been, somebody really needed to hear this today, what you're sharing. There's people out there right now that are in that dark place, you know, and this is great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything you'd want to say to anybody who's really right there in the pit of despair right now?
You know, my daughter sent us a book shortly after Amy passed. It was written by a mom who had two daughters with a very rare disease, and as she eventually, they both passed away. But she wrote it's just kind of what you just said, you know, the confusion, the question, you know, all the angst that we have sometimes are questions with God. The book was called Even in Darkness. And this is a quote from that book that I would just want to say to any, particularly moms out there, anyone that is really struggling. And here's the quote: "Rest in the embrace of the hands whose love bled for you. He is carrying you with those same scarred hands, whether circumstances or your emotions speak of it or not."
I want to thank Kim Hornbeck for sharing her story, and I hope you've been as blessed by hearing it as I have been. We want to close the show with a song based on the scripture in Philippians that says, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Thanks for listening. Hope you'll join us next week. God bless. I've been well and I've been sick. I've been first and the last one picked. I've had plenty and I've gone without. I've had faith and I've had some doubt. I've had friends and I've stood alone. I've been weak and I've been strong. I've been slandered and I've been praised. Been admired and called a disgrace. One thing I know, one thing I see, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I've had potential to reach the top. Been a has-been, I've been a flop. I've been ripped off and I've been blessed. But at this point in my life, I've got to confess. One thing I know, strengthens me. I've been through the fire and I've been through the flood. I've learned from it all. It's worked out for my good. In everything I've ever had to face, God gave the grace to see me through. Thank you.
I can do all things through Christ. I can go through it, whatever the price. I can do all things through Christ. Strengthens me.